Blog Talk Radio.
With the close of the American Revolution, the people found themselves facing the same problem that had precipitated the struggle. How could central authority be reconciled with personal liberty? England's failure to find an answer had aroused the colonists to rebellion. They feared that their fundamental rights were threatened by the overemphasis on authority. Now they must seek their own solution. For the next half dozen years, they experimented with various forms of government, always seeking one strong enough to be workable, but so restrained that their sacred liberties would not be imperiled. Not until they drafted the Federal Constitution in 1787 and added the Bill of Rights in 1791 did they find a partial answer. This broadcast delves into what the Founding Fathers intended during the framing of the United States Constitution, how this applies to government, and where we currently fall short. Welcome to the show that examines history and searches out the founding truth.
In order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Be ordained and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Gentlemen, and welcome to this edition of Founding Truth. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Article 5 of the United States Constitution. And to give you a little bit of insight, this is what Article 5 says. The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments, which, in either case, shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states, or by conventions in 3/4 thereof, as the one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by Congress, provided that no amendment which may be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of the first article, and that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Very short, very concise. And with us tonight, we have, as our guest, when he calls in, is going to be Mr. Bill Walker, co-founder of Friends of the Article 5 Convention. And this is what they are pushing for, is a convention in accordance with Article 5, where two-thirds of the states call for a convention, and Congress, at that point, shall start one. Or shall call for a convention. And this is very important because it has been done over 600 times in this nation's history that the states have called for an Article 5 convention. And that's all 50 states. But we still haven't had one. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and bring on our guest tonight. I think I am. There he is. Mr. Bill Walker, are you there, sir?
Yeah, can you hear me?
You're a little bit low.
Let's see. Give me a second to see if I can get my microphone a little low.
It sounds better now. I can hear you better.
Okay. Let's see. How's that? Does that sound better?
That's fine.
Okay. All right. Good, good. How are you doing this evening?
Well, I am doing just wonderfully, and I think that what your group is trying to do is very important because this is something we need in this country. And as far as what my opinion is, because I think that our government is way out of control, and the only way we can get it back is to make them follow the Constitution. And unfortunately, the only way I see doing that is maybe amending it to the point that they take it more seriously, that we basically rein them in under the law.
Well, I'd have to agree with you basically that, I mean, it'd have to be basically living under a rock right now with reading that the polls are 9% support of Congress. 64% of the American people don't like any of the presidential candidates that are running. You've got, for the first time in United States history, a majority of people in their own home congressional districts that are now finding fault with their members of Congress, saying that they are the reason for the situation rather than the traditional, well, everybody else is at fault, but we elect a good guy type attitude. It's pretty obvious that this country, regardless if you're a liberal or conservative, the consensus is pretty well getting pretty solid that there's problems here that this government just won't solve for whatever reasons. They just won't hear them.
Yeah, and we do have problems. So why don't you explain to us your group and what you actually you're a nonpartisan group.
Correct.
That is trying to get together to basically call for a constitutional convention in accordance with the Constitution of the United States.
Well, technically the term is an Article 5 convention because a lot of people, when they hear the term constitutional convention, think of the 1787 convention, and they get it all mixed up, and then starts all this, the convention's going to overthrow the Constitution and take away the Bill of Rights and all kinds of false statements. Just for the record, there has been over 500 conventions held in the United States and throughout the world since 1789, since or 1787, since our own convention. And not one of them has ever done all of these opponents and scaremongers have said. It's just that simple. There's no more danger of a convention doing anything than there would be of a convention held in a state legislature. They come together, they discuss amendments, they propose them, they go home. That's the only authority they've got. They don't have any military authority. They don't have any executive authority. They don't even have legislative authority to be able to tax, to be able to pay for their own costs. And this is what everybody's all feared about. Somebody or a group that has no power whatsoever. They write a proposed amendment. That's it. And the key point, as you read in Article 5, is it has to be ratified. If it is not ratified, it just dies. It goes away.
Right. Now, do you find there's a lot of confusion, even when they talk about the convention of 1787, people talk about that as a constitutional convention, and it wasn't that initially. That was not what their intent was, but it was to more revise or amend the Articles of Confederation. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, basically Congress issued a call under the Articles of Confederation, and this is important for people to understand. We have never had an Article 5 convention in this nation because the 1787 convention was authorized under the Articles of Confederation, not the Constitution, because the Constitution didn't exist. And the Articles of Confederation had a completely different language and legal interpretation than our current Article 5 convention. Frankly, the Articles of Confederation allowed for alteration of the Articles of Confederation, which means they could do anything that you wanted, including completely replacing the entire articles. Article 5, on the other hand, simply states that you have offer amendments to this Constitution, meaning that an amendment is going to still leave the original Constitution intact. That's why an Article 5 convention cannot write a new Constitution. And basically, the Congress said in its call, it said you're going to meet in May, and you're going to cause a convention, and that is basically all it said. Let me just quote what they actually said. The Congress issued it in February 21st, 1787. They said, "Resolved in the opinion of Congress, it is expedient that on the second Monday in May next, a convention of delegates who shall have been appointed by the several states be held in Philadelphia for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting to Congress and the several legislatures such alterations and provisions therein as shall, when agreed to in Congress and confirmed by the states, render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and the preservation of the Union." Now, note very carefully, they said Constitution, so they basically told the convention, make it a constitution.
Right. Now, why did they decide to do this? Why did they decide that they needed to do this at that point?
Well, in brief, the Articles of Confederation had one big major flaw in them, and the major flaw was that everything had to be decided by unanimous consent of all 13 states. The state of Rhode Island, for all intents and purposes, stymied everything. I mean, they could not make a decision on anything because Rhode Island simply said no. Fundamentally, they just acted as if they were a complete separate nation. And there was serious discussion at everything from literally marching in an army to basically them free as their own sovereign nation. There were that many frustrations. Finally, it built up to the point that the national leaders such as Washington and Madison and Jefferson, people like this, looked at it and said, we just got to go in and deal with this amendatory issue and fix the other problems that had developed, because other economic and political flaws in the original plan had by that time manifested themselves. So Congress finally called a convention.
Yeah, and I always in our studies, we do a show on Monday where we're going through the day-by-day debates on the Constitutional Convention, using Madison's mm-hmm. notes as our as the basis for those, and also Hamilton's and Rufus King's notes on the days that they took them. And what we're finding out is, and we're doing this as a project just to understand and to get people understanding why everything is in the Constitution. And, you know, we've been doing this for many months now, and I think we're up to all the way up to July 14th. So it's mm-hmm. a very slow process. We find we're becoming about a day at a time.
Which is about nice, because that's just about the amount of time that was it very nicely, because that just matches right up with what they actually did.
Yes, and, you know, it's an intense project, and to see what the debates were at that time, and then look at them, and, you know, and this is definitely, we're doing this from a nonpartisan point of view, but it is very difficult to look at what their views of this nation were in 1787 versus where this nation is today, and how our government is being run today.
Right. The one exception to that is the fact that the Article 5, the convention itself, was what I term road-tested. Conventions were quite common in those days. All of the states that held conventions, some of the European nations that held a convention. The founders, unlike a lot of it, if you read the Federalist Papers and you actually look at the language, you'll see a lot of it was what I would term speculative. They said, well, this will happen, this is, and, you know, this kind of concept idea. But contrast that to what Hamilton said in Federalist 85 about a convention. He was talking about the fact that the national government would be very reluctant to give up national power, which definitely has been true. And he states this in this way. He said, but there is yet a further consideration which proves beyond the possibility of a doubt that the observation is futile, meaning that Congress could prevent or take all power and there's nothing anybody could do about it. Excuse me. It is this, that the national rulers, whenever 9 states concur, will have no option on the subject. By the 5th article of the plan, Article 5, the Congress will be obligated on the application of the legislature's 2/3 of the states, which at present amount to 9, to call a convention for proposing amendments, which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of the Constitution, when ratified by the legislatures of 3/4 of the states, or by conventions in 3/4 thereof. The words of this article are peremptory. The Congress shall call a convention. Nothing in this particular is left to the discretion of the body. In other words, they were not stating a future, they were stating an exact fact. And more importantly, the word peremptory is key here. It is a legal term that has not changed in definition in 200 plus years. Exactly what Hamilton meant by the word peremptory in 1700s is exactly what it means today. And it basically is absolute, no choice, got to do it, period. There's no discretion or anything.
Even in Article 5 it says that.
Right.
It says
they say
shall. And, you know, right. My co-host is on right now. He just got home. I want to bring on Doug. This is Douglas V. Gibbs. He's the co-host for The Founding Truth. The two of us have taken on this venture. And, Doug, we're talking with Mr. Bill Walker, co-founder of Friends of the Article 5 Convention.
Well, you know, I was listening to everything on my cell phone coming in, and so I did catch it all. Mr. Walker, I do have a question, because I'm not a constitutional scholar per se. You know, I'm a layman, and I'm curious, what does this mean to us voters in layman's terms, the Article 5 Convention? Why is that so important, and why should it be called?
Well, the states have applied. We've been compiling the actual text of the applications. This has never been done before in history. And one of the main reasons that Congress has been able to get away with not calling a convention is that they have basically buried the applications from the states in the congressional record for well over 100 years. The states, all 50 of them, have applied over, as close as we can calculate right now, a total of about 600 to 650 times for an Article 5 convention.
Mm-hmm.
That's approximately 13 applications, roughly, per state, spread out over 100 years. That means that there should have been somewhere, because it's a two-thirds of the state legislatures, probably between 15 to 17 conventions over the last 100 years. And to just give you an idea of some of the things that have the states have applied for as issues, because all of the subjects of the applications are the same, a call for a convention. They are universal. They then have proposed various issues. Let me give some examples of some effects that would occur. If the Constitution had been obeyed and Congress would be following the Constitution, you would not be paying federal income tax. 39 states, according to the records, have asked for the repeal of federal income tax. Now, I'm talking probably everybody in your listening audience would not be paying federal income tax. Therefore, their incomes would be somewhere between 30 to 50% higher right now.
Hmm.
So there's one effect. You probably would not have the situation of the Iraqi war as it exists today. The reason is because if you look at the timing of the applications at about 1963-64, right in that time range, there would have been a convention. The situation politically would have been that Lyndon Johnson and others who would have followed would be a lot more hesitant at going into Vietnam and other places with a convention sitting there, or could be called quickly, that could basically say simply, okay, if you're going to commit federal troops, they have to do it with an actual declaration of war. You can't do it with a resolution that's may or may not be a real declaration. I doubt that either conservatives or liberals would argue over that. You got 58,000 American lives that might have been spared by the fact of the Congress had obeyed the Constitution. You can go on and on and on. The 17th Amendment. The states asked for a convention. The fact is that they asked for it in 1911. In 1911, there were 46 states in the Union. They submitted 31 applications. Simple math, that's two-thirds. Everybody says, well, Congress wrote it, and that satisfied them. No, it didn't, because the states also wanted to discuss the direct election of a president and vice president, so you would have not had an electoral college all through the 20th century. And you can keep finding examples of it. Balanced budget, you wouldn't have the debt that we're talking about because of the situation of such things as, say, the Vietnam War. You wouldn't have had the disgrace at the end of it of us losing, thus leading to the conclusions by the terrorists today that we're a weak nation. And it just follows in point after point, all because Congress has vetoed the Constitution of the United States and has done so, I should point out, and I'm sure we'll get into this a little more depth, in criminal violation of their oath of office. And I'm not talking criminal in the sense like, oh, this is a really criminal thing. I'm talking actual criminal acts committed by the members of Congress.
You know, it's all about power, isn't it? If the people are able to call for these Article 5 conventions, that takes away a lot of power from the politicians, doesn't it?
Oh, no question about it. The main thrust of these applications has been the states wanting to, as it were, balance the books over the federal authorities that have been taken. They've talked, their main applications are Supreme Court rulings and United States congressional actions. Nobody, just for the record, with 600 applications, not one application has ever been received about getting rid of the Bill of Rights, overwriting a new constitution, or anything like that. So, you know, I mean, it's pragmatic, hard politics. And yes, Congress just flat out refuses to obey the Constitution. There's no other way to phrase it. It's not even a subtle decision anymore. It's just a blatant criminal action on the part of the members of Congress.
And because, again, you know, Doug and I have talked about this word shall. We talked about it when we were discussing the Second Amendment.
Right.
Where it talks about the rights of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And it's the same thing. And it has the same meaning today as it did back then. As you said before, Bill, it's an absolute. Now, if they would put should, that's different.
Right, but they put shall.
They put shall. And what we are seeing by our Congress, by the states calling for an Article 5 convention, that the word shall in there is being totally ignored by our Congress.
Mm-hmm. That sums it up precisely. That's exactly the situation. FOAVC has been working for, we got founded about approximately 2 years ago now, has been working to get members of Congress to respond on this. And, well, let me read a member's letter. I mean, it's two paragraphs. Let me just read how a typical response of talking to them goes. The member wrote about when he's talked to the about talking to members of Congress as they've been campaigning for office. He says, "Bill, I have openly confronted Congress members in public arenas now directly. This campaign season is open season on them. They all respond with thundering silence, completely dumbfounded. One chased me down after the showbiz to ask about it. They didn't have a clue what the Constitution says. It's not just that they don't address the issue. Neither the members or their staff have a clue. I'm really glad that 225 years ago they wrote the word peremptory into the Constitution. So it's more important than ever that all the applications from the congressional record are compiled in a public compendium readily available to anyone who wants to look. I gave my last dictum, Representative Zero Rodriguez, who is from the state of Texas, the FOAVC.org site to refer to the applications. He kept wanting to know the date that Texas sent its applications to Congress. Hope the information is there for him." And yes, it is. We have all of the applications listed, and I said we're gathering all of them. About 450 of them are text now that you can just simply go on and read them yourselves, and we will eventually have them all. "He was almost catatonic when I hit him with the Article 5 question after having ranted and raved for 2 hours on every imaginable topic under the sun." Unquote. So that is basically what members of Congress are like. And I don't care if you're talking about Barack Obama, John McCain, Hillary Clinton, Ron Paul. They're all the same. You literally have what everybody always talks about. They want bipartisanship in Congress. Well, on this, you have 100% bipartisanship.
Right. Well, you have the people. The people are speaking. The people are tired.
Yeah.
And what I tell my listeners out there, that the Constitution was not written for the government. The Constitution was written for the people.
Hence the first three words.
We the people. It was written to protect the people from their government.
Correct.
And
it was designed to limit the government, not the people.
Absolutely. And to get, there are people out there that actually think that, you know, they'll ask me when I start talking about this, and they'll say, "Well, where'd you get your law degree?" And I said, "Well, I don't have one." And then said, "Well, maybe you should get one, and then you'll understand it." And I'm sitting there going, "Well, wait a minute. It was written for the people. All you have to do is pick it up and read it. And read Madison's notes."
Well, and Loki, you know the Constitution better than any lawyer I've ever met. Doesn't
let me
take
tell
the
you,
degree.
It's a long time. It does not come overnight. If you really want to understand it, you have to just not read the Constitution. You also have to read the notes from the 1787 Convention. You have to read the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers. You have to read writings and congressional records, you know, to understand what everything means. But it's all there. All you have to do is want to find it.
It's all public record. Yes.
Yeah.
And the thing that I think that is very important to understand about an Article 5 convention is that it is a right. It's the same right as freedom of speech. You mentioned the Second Amendment. It's the same right as the Fourth Amendment's rights, or Sixth. Doesn't make any difference. The Constitution, if you really read it and study it, it's nothing but practically rights. I mean, we have, for example, the right to a public record of the actions of our legislators. And we have the right to see that if they commit felonies, they can face arrest. These are rights that are in the Constitution, and their history is just as twisted and convoluted getting those rights for the people as having free speech. People don't grasp the significance of the Article 5, because what it is in its basic form is the expression, the central expression of the Declaration of Independence, which was the right of the people to alter or to abolish their form of government. The founders put that in the Article 5 Convention so that that right, that basic right, that basically everything else of the American people's rights derives from, could be actually undertaken and done. They gave it a mechanism to be able to be done. And that's what an Article 5 Convention is. If we don't like the way government's doing something, and it's a systematic situation, which I think everybody would concede today it is, there's been sufficient a number of elections back and forth now to prove that it's not going to be solved by electing this party or that party. When it's that kind of situation, you don't try to elect a president or a particular party. You go to the amendment process and change the system. And that's what an Article 5 is intended to do. When the government won't do it or can't do it, the Article 5 Convention steps in and does it.
Now, here's another question for you. Now, if everyone, and they should be approved, we should have an Article 5 Convention looking at the applications coming in from the various states and the number of applications that have come in. Now, don't we also have to be careful as far as the states go, as far as who they will, you know, send to that convention? You know, I'm looking at, you know, we want to also make sure that you send level-headed individuals. You don't want a group from, you know, have a whole bunch of people from PETA or this group or that group or anybody else that's going to go there and change the Constitution in some way that what I would say would be willy-nilly changes and changes.
Well,
that,
first of all, the delegates all have to be elected. And let's take the practical side of politics for a couple of minutes. Since the Supreme Court ruled way back in the 1920s that the Article 5 Convention delegates have to be elected, just like the convention delegates for ratification conventions, you're going to have literally everybody that's going to seek delegate position be vetted. Now, I personally believe in the American people. I think this is a great nation. I think the American people are a great people. And one of the reasons they're a great people is they're a level-headed, overall level-headed bunch of people. And when they get to a serious decision about things in an election, they don't tend, as a general rule, to elect flaky people. They tend to elect people that are serious about the issues and serious candidates. That being the case, you know, I don't think we have to worry about delegates. I don't think you're going to get people past the electoral group in the first convention that are going to be that you're talking about. They just are not going to get there. They aren't going to get the support from the people. There's no other way to phrase it. I mean, if somebody walks in and they are, say, from some extremist group, that's going to get pointed out. I mean, when you have this Article 5 Convention, it's not like it's going to be something quietly put in. Maybe, you know, if you're lucky on the back page of your local newspaper down by the bottom of the classified ads is a little one-inch story that says there's a convention. It's going to be over everything. The blogosphere is going to explode. You're going to have stories and newspaper articles and television coverage on these candidates. You're going to have people having to debate the issues and take a position on what is your issue. For example, repeal of income tax, what is your position? They aren't going to just walk in and just be, how shall I phrase it, they're just not going to walk in like it's Sunday Park and say, you know, here's three of my guys, and now I'm a delegate voting for me, and that's it. You're going to have real interest. And that interest is going to act as a big, giant filter. So my concern is not, the delegates being elected. My concern is the elected members of Congress refusing to obey the Constitution, because what we have here, everybody talks about the worries of a runaway convention. Well, the fact is there's never been one, but the fact is there is a runaway Congress, a runaway government, period. It is a fact. And
absolutely,
that should concern more people, because unlike a convention, like I said, that can't propose or can do only proposal of amendments, you've got a runaway government that has control of a military. That, well, let me read one of the decisions concerning Article 5 Convention to just give you an idea of the extensive nature that the courts have said that Congress has. They did this in Colin v. Miller, 1939. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but let me read just a couple of things with that the courts have said. The court here treats the amending process of the Constitution in some respects as subject to judicial construction, in others as subject to the final authority of Congress. On the other hand, the court's opinion declares that Congress has the exclusive power to decide the political questions of whether a state whose legislature has once acted on a proposed amendment may subsequently reverse its position. Such position division between the political and judicial branches of the government is made by Article 5, which grants power over the amending process to the Constitution to Congress alone. Undivided control of that process has been given by the article exclusively, completely, to Congress. Since Congress has sole and complete control over the amended process, subject to no judicial reviews, the view of any court on this process cannot be binding upon Congress. Congress, possessing exclusive control over the amended process, cannot be bound and is under no duty to accept the pronouncements upon that exclusive power by this court. Therefore, any judicial expression amounting to more than a mere acknowledgement of exclusive congressional power over the political process of amendment is a mere admonition to the Congress in the nature of an advisory opinion given wholly without constitutional authority. Well, let me continue. Then the Coleman got into talking about the states and ratification. Without going through a lot of details on the thing, let me just read a section of it. On July 9, 1868, Congress adopted a resolution requesting the Secretary of State to communicate a list of states in the Union that had ratified the 14th Article of Amendment. And in Secretary Seward's report, attention was called to the action of New Jersey and Ohio. Basically, what Ohio and New Jersey was, they rescinded their approval of ratification. Also, the states of North Carolina, South Carolina, also did the same thing. It was deemed a matter of doubt and uncertainty whether such resolutions are not irregular, invalid, and therefore ineffectual. The Secretary certified the ratifying resolutions of New Jersey and Ohio, which had been drawn by the state legislatures, were in full effect and force. They also, by the way, approved that the states of North Carolina and South Carolina could be, let me quote it exactly. The legislatures of Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina had rejected the amendment in November and December 1866. New governments were erected in these states and others under the direction of Congress. In other words, they went in with the military, they took over the state legislatures, and they forced them to vote for an amendment. That is part of the ratification power of Congress.
Okay, yeah.
That's right out of Coleman v. Miller.
We do have another call. I got him unmuted. 808, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me. You know, I got to say, I have found over, you know, the past year that Loki is a very knowledgeable person about the Constitution. And as I put in the chat room, I learned more on my own just in researching and finding out on my own more about the Constitution than I did in law school. So it is absolutely true that you need to read the articles of the Constitution, the amendments, as well as the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, and all the writings of the time to really get a good feel. But as far as Article 5 conventions, I think the most important thing to really rebalance the government is to reinstate the 10th Amendment and to put a new definition of the Commerce Clause, because they have obviously overstretched what they think the Commerce Clause means to really grab any power that they can get in the federal government. I think the loss of the balance between the federal government and the states has been the most damaging, and that's my comment. I just want to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, the states have applied for some 17 or 18 issues, which I think would clearly show that they also would hold that. Now, I cannot recall specifically if the 10th Amendment, I don't think it has ever been discussed by the states as an application. If they were to do that, it would probably be something along the lines like they did with the 21st Amendment, where they repealed the 18th Amendment. I don't think that would be very popular. I think a new amendment to revise the Commerce Clause could be discussed. I think that the any part of the Constitution can, of course, be amended. But the general rule of amendments, because of the difficult nature of getting them by, you're talking two-thirds of either a convention or a state or the Congress itself. Then you're talking three-quarters of ratification. The more radical the amendment, the less chance of ratification. Now, there's been something like 10,000 amendments proposals submitted to Congress. We've only had 27 that have ever made it.
Right.
10 of them were proposed by the original Congress. So getting an amendment is not
actually, weren't there 11 proposed by the original Congress?
12.
Well, there were 12, and one, the last one was actually was the 27th Amendment that wasn't ratified until the 90s.
Right, 1992, correct. Yeah. The getting an amendment, it's like building a skyscraper. The amendment process is designed to be the beams of the building. It sets up a framework. It is not designed to go in and solve every single problem. And a smart convention, and I think the people that would step forward to be convention delegates, I think would be wise. They would realize that what they needed to do was give the people the tools so that in turn they could solve all problems. A lot of the issue with the amendments that he spoke of have to do with Supreme Court rulings. Now, the states have proposed at least two different ways to review Supreme Court rulings, but Congress hasn't allowed the system to be discussed. And that's basically what we're talking about. We're talking about censorship here. I'm not saying that all these proposals would make it. In fact, I'd be very surprised if there were very many amendments that came out of a convention, even with the 18 and 19 issues that have been discussed. But I don't think that anyone would say it's the American way that a Congress just simply refuses to obey the Constitution and quells the entire subject. I don't think that's the American way. I think the American people are wise enough and smart enough to debate and argue over issues and resolve them.
I do have a question for you concerning when you talk about these, they wanted to review Supreme Court rulings. Now, it's been my understanding through my readings that the courts were set up not to give rulings, but to give opinions. The rulings mm-hmm. that they can give were very, very specific on where what their jurisdiction was and what constituted their authority. And what we see today in our courts, in our federal court system, is they are basically nullifying state law.
Right.
And I think this is what the caller was, you know, talking about, going back again to the 10th Amendment. And where we are seeing the federal government overstepping their bounds in the 10th Amendment, and also the federal judiciary is and this is my opinion based on my studies, that the judiciary is way overstepping their bounds because they give nothing more than opinions. Now, it was initially set up that they would review like a law that the Congress passed, and they would put down their opinion whether it was or was not constitutional, and then it was up to the Congress to review that and review that law and bring it back within the fold if they deemed it necessary. I mean, and everybody says that we have three equal branches in our federal government, and I say no, we don't. We have two equal branches, and then we have the judiciary. They were never supposed to be three equal because the founders were very scared of a tyrannical judiciary. That was the one thing that I think scared them more than anything else, that the judiciary itself would get out of hand.
Well, in that regard, then, I would say that the listener should go to FOABC.org and read the application that we have. And, yeah, they talk about the term that they use in the application is called Court of the Union. And there is another process. I'm unfamiliar with the details of it. But basically, it was a way that if the states didn't agree with decisions by the Supreme Court, they could be reviewed. I think there was one where they proposed it be done by the Chief Justices of the 50 states, the other one where it was done by the Court of the Union. Now, FOABC doesn't take any position on any amendment proposal, but you can see where what you were discussing, the 10th Amendment, Commerce Clause, rulings or opinions by the courts could then be looked at by the states. And basically, making it so that these rulings were not just supreme without anybody being able to have a say in them. Now, whether these would be accepted by people, whether it's a good idea, I'll make no statement on it because, like I said, we're nonpartisan. We aren't going to take a position on these. But they are out there and should be, in my mind, at least available to be discussed by the public. The quality of the amendment proposal certainly deserves at least public discussion of it, and Congress is stymieing that idea. Now, maybe it's a great idea, maybe it's not. I won't take an opinion, but certainly it should be at least discussed.
Can I ask one more question? Am I still on?
Absolutely.
Sure.
Do you see any way that the federal government, meaning the Congress, will ever vote to reduce the own power that they have? Well, at least not the people that are there now. Maybe if we replace the entire Congress with people who are willing to do that. But do you see any way that they'll give back the power that they have, what I would say unconstitutionally, taken for themselves?
Let me answer this by telling you about the two lawsuits that I brought in federal court, and I think you'll have your answer. I brought the first federal lawsuit called Walker v. United States in 2000, deal directly with the question of Congress calling an Article 5 convention. In 2005, if memory serves correctly, 2004, I filed a second lawsuit, Walker v. Members of Congress, which sued every member of Congress individually. Eventually, the second lawsuit ended up at the Supreme Court, who denied the review, or cert, as they call it. But before they did that, they had to, by federal law, the Supreme Court rulings are, or excuse me, Supreme Court rules that they operate under are federal law. They're in 28 U.S.C. Appendix, if anybody wants to read them. Excuse me. One of the rules that the court operates under, caught by the Constitution itself, is that before the court can decide to hear the case, it has to decide or has to determine the issue of fact and law. Now, I brought this lawsuit, and I maintained two points. That, first of all, the convention call was based on the numeric count of states. In other words, a simple numeric count. 34 states apply, you call a convention. No ifs, ands, buts, maybes about it. It says two-thirds. It's not exactly rocket science to figure out that's a numeric count. The second thing I said was, and without going into a lot of in-depth legal details, I basically said, okay, among 13 other criminal actions that Congress has taken, among them criminal conspiracy, because there's more than one member of Congress, they have criminally violated their oath of office. Now, it is a criminal offense for a member of Congress not to support the Constitution as required by his oath of office. If he has a mental reservation, that is a violation if he publicly declares it. Now, by forcing the members of Congress to actually join the office, they had to publicly declare their position on this. They had to advocate publicly that they did not want to obey their oath of office. Every single member of Congress admitted, expressed by their attorney of record, Solicitor General of the United States, officially and formally at the Supreme Court, that they were committing a criminal act. So in answer to your question, I would say they're willing to go to the mat on this one to keep their power.
I agree. I don't see any other way other than the state legislatures having enough people in them who are willing to go vocally stand up and say, we demand our Article 5 convention, enough to ask for it, and we will not let you anymore bully the states around.
Well, they've done that four times already. If you go to the applications, you'll see where they brought that and exactly that. And the response of Congress was a brilliant silence. In other words, the only way this is going to get done now is to basically ask a question that I've asked OABC members to ask. And I would ask every member of Congress this question if it were in my power. In 2006, you joined a federal lawsuit to declare you and the other members of Congress had the right to veto the law of the Constitution under the political question doctrine. Suit was Walker v. Members of Congress, which dealt with the peremptory obligation of Congress to call an ratified convention. There are over 600 applications on file from all 50 states. Only 34 applications from 34 states are required in order to have Congress issue a call. The actual texts of these are available for public viewing at foabc.org. Your attorney of record, the Solicitor General of the United States, stated at the Supreme Court that the required call is based solely on numeric count of states. He also stated that by you even joining this federal lawsuit and asserting in a public lawsuit you have a right to veto the Constitution, you violated federal criminal law, specifically your oath of office. And for anybody who's interested in looking up, the criminal penalty is at 18 U.S.C. 1918, and the other citations from that can be found from there. Would you share on why you feel you have the right to veto the Constitution, if you plan on vetoing other sections of the Constitution, and why you chose to commit a criminal act? And finally, has your position changed on your opposition to an Article 5 convention? In other words, the only way this is going to happen, coupled with it, I can tell you what the reaction is. I have personally contacted my congressman here in Washington State. That's where I live. And I have gotten a thundering silence, even from their opponent. I literally come to the opponent of this person who is in a neck-to-neck race with the convention, with this member of Congress, and I have literally said, here is the criminal act of a member of Congress seeking office re-election, and they won't deal with it. Now, you got to ask yourself, you know, how in are these two parties with each other when you would literally hand a person seeking the office the election? Because who's going to vote for a member of Congress that has committed a criminal act? It just isn't going to happen, particularly when that is that they're not going to obey the law that of the Constitution. I mean, it's almost a guaranteed vote against that person. You know, who's going to support that kind of person? And you can't even get these people. They're so bad they won't even tell me where I can interview them and ask them a public question. That's how scared they are of an Article 5 pension.
Mr. Walker.
Yeah, I agree, yeah. Thanks for letting me on, and I'll listen to the rest.
Thanks, David.
Thanks for the call, David.
Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Walker, how successful has your organization website been in educating regarding Article 5, and how much more do you think everybody else, such as Loki and I, what can we do to continue to educate and possibly move in the direction of bringing on a Article 5 convention?
Well, the first thing I would say is that you continually talk about it to your various listeners and tell them about an Article 5 and keep mentioning this so that it spreads. We started out, like I said, about a year, year and a half, 2 years ago, and we started out with seven members, and we had we have a group that is of loyal Americans, and they are as politically diverse as you can name. We can find every type of political stripe you could name, from ultra-liberal to ultra-conservative. The one thing they share is they believe the Constitution must be obeyed. They are spreading the word. We have had interviews on radio, both live air and interviews like this. We've had numerous internet articles, and we would hope that people would just keep talking about this and start to bring political pressure by any means that you can come up with on the members of Congress. Remember, when November comes and we vote for the president, by the way, you got to remind yourself that all three senators who are currently running for office, remember, all of them joined this lawsuit. Whoever wins, they are going to be committing a perjury when they take that oath of office. They do not believe in obeying the Constitution of the United States. That is a matter of public record. So it doesn't matter which candidate you're talking about. But anyway, the convention can be held at any time, so it doesn't stop with the convention with the election at that point. It continues on. We could hold a convention next year. We can hold a convention in 2 years. It could coincide with elections. It could be its own special election. It's not tied to the election cycle, meaning this issue can be pressed and pressed and pressed, and it should be by any citizen who is concerned about this nation. I mean, let me give you one example that lets you get an idea. We're all concerned about gas prices these days. If one proposal from one state in 1929 were on the books today as an amendment, the state of Wisconsin asked for initiative referendum recall on national level. Now, the details, of course, were not made out at that point. They might have been different. But let's just assume that the referendum existed right now. What would be the difference of the American people now having a referendum before them to decide whether or not they're going to drill? Rather than a bunch of politicians sitting in Washington making a decision, the American people could be deciding. Now, maybe they decide, no, we want to be worried about the environment, so on and so forth. Or maybe they'd say, yeah, let's go out and do it and go for it. But the point is, it would be the American way to decide it. The Americans would get together, the people would decide, they'd debate the issue, and ultimately there would be a resolution, which would have been provided by an Article 5 convention giving the people the tools to make a decision.
You know, and it's interesting because you look at examples such as the will of the people being overturned in California over the Marriage Act being overturned by the court. Now there's on the ballot in November is going to be there's an initiative for a constitutional amendment, but wouldn't if it starts moving in a federal direction and the court system is trying to, and I'm just using this as an example, court system trying to overturn the will of the people in that direction, couldn't a then Article 5 convention by the people then overturn that?
Well, you're talking about a system that would not probably be used that way. I mean, politics is cyclical. Problems come up. They're decided, they're argued, they fade away, okay? The longest running debate we ever had in our nation's history lasted over 100 years, which was the issue of slavery.
Right.
That's pretty unusual. If you stop and think about it, basically our political questions pretty much follow the election of a president or a major event such as a war or something like that. Given that, an amendment probably would not be the effective way that people would choose. I mean, you're going to have, first of all, you'd have to have the applications. Let's just assume that the slate is cleared again. Let's just assume that a convention was called by Congress. It's cleared the 600-plus applications. They've been discharged. So we're starting over. The states would have to, at this point, assuming there was no changes to Article 5, would have to then reapply to Congress. The average time that it's taken for them to do it is 3 to 4 to 5 years to get up a set of applications, and sometimes longer. So now this decision by the Supreme Court is going to be 3 to 4 or 5 years down the line. Then you've got to have the convention propose it and get it ratified. You're looking at it could be several years past that. So using an amendment to defeat a Supreme Court ruling in the sense of directly this makes the court an opinion, the amendment stops it, is pretty cumbersome. I mean, yes, you could do it, true, but there are a lot more efficient ways to arrive at that. For example, Congress could legislatively deal with it rather than doing it. You have the fact that members of the courts are changed. They retire, resign, so on and so forth. The court could be changed. And given that you're talking with an amendment process of three-quarters support, you're going to have a lot of public debate that's going to lengthen it out. So it would be like trying to drive a big, huge, you know, double-decker bus down to the store and park in a little sports car parking space. Yeah, you can do it, but it's a real cumbersome system. So I would say no. I don't think a convention would directly deal with it. Now, they might deal with, and like I said, the states have made applications for this, of reviewing that decision. They might say, okay, if we have an issue with these decisions, this is a process where the states can thereby take a look at it.
Okay.
And then that would then be where that thing, if that were in place, could then be discussed. Now, that would be immediate. See, again, a tool has been provided by amendment that then provides a methodology whereby American people can debate that particular issue. So I would say the amendment would be used to provide the tool, but it's unlikely that it would be used to provide the actual blockage.
Yeah, and I think what Bill's saying is we have to be very careful. If we're going to amend the Constitution, and I believe this wholeheartedly, we have to be very careful on what we put into it.
Oh, guaranteed.
Well, the founding fathers made it a difficult thing to do for a reason.
They made it right. Yeah. They made it very difficult to get by. I mean, you're talking major obstacles here. To you know, if you look at the issues that are being discussed, you're just not going to have a lot of unanimity at a convention. It's a lot of horseplaying and politics and debate just to get them out of a convention. Then you've got the ratification. The people that are opposed or for a particular proposal are not just going to retire because the convention proposed it and go home. I mean, they can read the Article 5 just like anybody else. All they've got to get is 14 states against it. It's basically a system designed for consent of the minority, not the decision of the majority.
Oh, and you're right, but that's why they chose it, because they wanted to ensure, number one, that there was a mechanism there to change it. But they wanted to make sure that it wasn't that somebody just got a wild hair up their whatever and decided they wanted this now.
Right.
And it became.
Right. And it's a good system, because if you stop and think about it, it's basically split up when it's supposed to be split up. Of course, the Congress has usurped the convention, so it's not doing what it's supposed to. But in the theory of it, you've got two different ways to propose something. If the Congress won't or can't deal with the subject, you can go to the states. But even there, you've got a problem. You've got to get enough states that say, hey, we want a convention application. And so you've got to get two-thirds of them to go to the Congress and say, make a call. Well, right there, you're going to have a roadblock right there. Is convincing these state legislatures, both houses, by the way, to vote to go for this. So there's one all right there. Even if you get past that, then you've got to go into the convention itself and now convince a bunch of elected delegates who are not state legislatures. They're out of the picture. So now you've got a second wall to get over, and it's an even a bigger wall, because these people are going to become ready for bear for that issue. Then once you get it written, and remember, they write it, so whatever you got in mind may not be what comes out.
Right.
Then you got to go back to the state legislatures or to conventions, and you got to get that passed. Now that's a big, huge climb. It's not people that get a convention passed have a right to, or an amendment passed have a right to pat themselves on the back. They've done a lot of work. It isn't like you just walk out and say today there will be an amendment.
Yeah, and we have to, you know, even have to look at the convention of 1787. That took what? That was from May to September.
Correct.
In Philadelphia, it did. They just didn't walk in there and say, "This is what we're going to do."
Oh no, no, they.
You know, a tremendous.
They started out, right? They started out in May with basically Virginia and a couple other plans that just basically said, well, we'd like to do this, this, and this, and this. And they just hacked through, as you've shown with your daily debates, they just hacked through piece by piece by piece by piece through the Articles of Confederation, looking at the ideas. And, I mean, there were all kinds of ideas that were suggested, rejected, debated, modified, put together, taken apart. There was hundreds of ideas for the Constitution. It was not... You know, three guys sat down, wrote the Constitution, and, you know, five guys passed it, and that was it. Let's go out and, you know, have dinner. It wasn't that way at all.
Oh, yeah, it was tremendous. Well, I was going to take a break. We were about over an hour into the show. Bill, are you able to hang around?
Sure.
Okay. But
so you're saying it's time for a break, Loki?
It's time for a break. I need to stretch my legs a wee bit.
Yeah, well, and folks, you're listening to Founding Truth Radio. We're speaking with Bill Walker of Friends of the Article 5 Convention. We have Loki from the Halls of Valhalla, A Newt One, American Truth Warriors, and Doug from Political Pistachio. Chime it up, brother.
Okie dokie. So this is a very good discussion we're having, and I'm very appreciative to Mr. Walker for being here this evening. And he is actually talking about something that is very, very important to this nation as a whole. And it doesn't matter which political party you believe you belong to or what your political philosophy is. This
right.
is something that we need to get nailed down. And this is the only way that we, the people, are going to have the ability to take our country back.
And notice it's on this
country.
And notice it's on this new media that this is being talked about. We're not hearing about this on the old media. We're not hearing about this on the mainstream media because they've got their own agendas.
Yeah, mine is to make my country a better place to live.
There you go.
Well, the press, I would have to say, definitely wants this under wraps. They don't want people knowing about the power they've got. And that's what this is. It's a power of the people. I mean, let me give you an example of just what kind of power you're talking about. When I was doing my lawsuits, you got to remember, I'm not a lawyer either. I'm not an attorney. And
I salute you for that.
When I doing my lawsuits and I had finished my first lawsuit, I wrote a letter to the Supreme Court of the United States about it, and I pointed out to them that they had a real problem. The courts had said, well, under the political question doctrine, Congress can veto the Constitution, basically. And I said, well, you got a problem. If you declare something to be unconstitutional, you're in contempt of a court order that now says that Congress doesn't have to obey the Constitution. So I wrote that right after the decision. And I got a letter response from a guy named Guria, who was the attorney for the actual justices. He was their legal attorney. They got one, which surprised me. I mean, everybody's a lawyer there, and they got their own attorney. But anyway, 6 months later, I made a phone call to Mr. Guria about some point, and I don't recall exactly what it was that I was going to ask him. But you got to remember, this is the Supreme Court of the United States. They get hundreds of phone calls, letters, mails, every day, okay? I sent one letter to the guy, and 6 months later, I call him up. I said my name. I didn't identify myself otherwise. I said my name. And you could have heard, you knew instantly, he knew exactly who I was. That's the kind of power an Article 5 convention has to the officials of this country. That's how long that letter had stuck with him. Even though he gave a completely, I don't know what word to use, but just totally blasé answer that doesn't mean anything, the real fact was that it scared him because it hit truth. Obviously, the court rules a decision or makes an opinion, it can hold that you're in contempt if you don't go along with what the court said. He knew I was right.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to take a break.
That's why they're scared.
Oh, they're real scared. And we'll talk about more on that when we come back. And we'll take about five, and everybody go up, stretch your legs, get some more popcorn, get another cold refreshment or whatever, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to Founding Truth. And I want to thank everybody for hanging on to the break. We were talking with Mr. Bill Walker, co-founder of Friends of the Article 5 Convention. And we're talking about our rights and what our rights are as citizens of this great nation and what we as citizens of this great nation need to do to ensure that we are being heard. And that Washington is actually, and this is what it all boils down to, it that Washington is listening to us. Because they do work for us, we do not work for them. So I bring back Mr. Bill Walker and my co-host, Mr. Douglas V. Gibbs. Gentlemen, are we ready to continue on?
Let's roll.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Doug, you're up, buddy.
Well, you know, I'm listening to this entire conversation, and, you know, and I'll be honest with you, Loki and I have been doing this show for a while, but I always tell everybody he's the brains of the operation. But I've learned a lot about the Constitution through him. One thing that I find fascinating, though, is to me, by reading the Constitution, it is apparent, it is obviously apparent that it is designed to limit the power of central government. And something like this, the Article 5 Convention, that's exactly its primary function, really, is to give the people a voice. What was the thing that made this so that it became forgotten, or is this kind of something that pushed down from the very beginning?
I would say, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Yeah, okay.
Yes, we can hear you.
Couldn't tell my own earphones. But, I would say that this has been a deliberate conspiracy, and I, like I said, this we're talking criminal conspiracy here, by Congress, basically since the beginning. Clear back as far, at least to the 20th century, judging by the text. I mean, when they wanted direct election of the senators, and whether to support the 17th Amendment or not is not the point of my discussion. The point was that applications for conventions started coming back approximately 1893. I think Pennsylvania was the first one. By 1911, all 31 states had applied for conventions. Now, Congress should have called. Now, to give you an idea how blatant this is ignored, we have discovered in the congressional record a complete summary of all the applications by Congress in the congressional record showing and listing all of them for this particular subject. So that was done in 1910. They knew that they were supposed to call attention. Instead, they simply ignored it. They made no effort whatsoever. And they had them all compiled. I mean, we're talking a complete state-by-state listing of these things. And the Congress has been asked at least four times by the states. We've got the applications right on our website where you can read them specifically and said, look, this is an American count. Two-thirds of the states have applied. We want a convention. And the response of Congress has always been exactly the same, absolute, utter silence. Now, in the 1970s, because the balanced budget was proposed, and by the way, that's I think, if I remember correctly, 37 applications, meaning it's one shy of ratification. Income taxes got 39, which means it should have been ratified. Apportionment's got like 38. Because of that, they started writing legislation to deal with the quote-unquote problems of an Article 5 convention. Now, let's strip what a convention really is down to its essence, its real actual essence. It's a committee meeting. Okay? I mean, yes, it's got the Constitution behind it, and yes, it's got historic consequences and so on and so forth. But basically, all it is a committee meeting. You've got a bunch of people coming together, they got an assignment, they make a discussion, they propose it up to the big bosses, and they leave. It's a committee meeting. And with all the experience of 300 million minds in this country that have dealt in business issues and clubs and so on and so forth, I'm sorry, I just don't believe we haven't got enough experience to run a simple committee meeting. Well, anyway, they started proposing legislation, and if you study this legislation all the way through, it all had one common thing. that they could veto the amendments, that they could control every aspect of a convention. In other words, basically, the legislation is the expression of Congress saying, we're just going to control this thing with a fist. So it has been buried deliberately and willfully, and with cold-blooded political calculation. There is no question about it. When you look at the record, you look at the application, you look what happened with my lawsuit, you put the whole thing together, there's no conclusion left but that Congress just flat out wants raw political power, and they'll do anything necessary to hang on to it.
Sounds almost like an aristocracy.
you forget the Coleman rulings. We're talking that they could usurp the president, order troops to a state legislature, and take it over. And the court says, yeah, that's a political question, all right. Yeah, that's fine, no problem.
Gee,
I mean,
we do.
Yeah, it is an aristocracy. I mean, we're not talking like it is a dictatorship. That's what it is.
And we do have another call, Bill, if you're willing to take another call. Here's a question for you.
Sure.
And I'm going to bring him on. Mail Geek, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Or evening, I guess it is now, most of the country. my question is, is the requirement for the convention two-thirds of the state petitioning Congress or particularly petitioning a specific instance of Congress? A Congress, as we call it.
Oh, okay. It says on the application, let me see if I remember words myself, on the application of the, let's see, I'll read it exactly because it answers the question. On the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the states, Congress, in brackets, shall call a convention for proposed amendments. There is no other terms expressed. It transcends all sessions of Congress. So in other words, if the states applied, say, 16 applied one session of Congress and the rest applied the next session of Congress, that session of Congress has got a call. They do not die. They stay in. There is no expression in Article 5 to rescind or remove any application. Once a state made it, it stays ongoing until Congress discharges it by issuing a call.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call. And this is, you know, this is very disturbing, you know, and I was unaware if this was going on, Bill. I really was. I didn't realize that the Congress had been not allowing this to happen and that there had been so many applications for an Article 5 convention.
Yeah.
And I think this is another thing.
I think if there were like 20 or say 35 or 40 applications, a lot of people would have sloughed this off. But 600, nearly 650, that's kind of hard to ignore.
Yeah.
It's obvious the states know about the Article 5 because of so many applications.
Right, and it's obvious to understand exactly, if you read the text, it's obvious to understand what it means.
Right.
Inevitably, an application, most applications have kind of a pattern. There's no form exactly as to how them, but most states follow this form, and it's very standard in this. They will usually start out as, you know, you've read
Bill,
the lawyer, and they give all the where.
Yep. Bill, your phone's breaking up, and it's about that time of the evening that the bandwidth gets very, very large on the Internet, and I'm thinking that's why it's happening. If it is possible, if you could call in on a landline or a cell phone, I think it would go a little bit smoother from this point on, but since you're calling in over the Internet, the bandwidth is getting quite large, and I had that problem with me also.
Are you having trouble hearing me now? Am I okay now?
Yeah, it is, but
breaking
it's
up
been
a little
breaking
bit.
Up.
Okay.
I mean, it's not the volume.
Let me finish this point, and I'll hang up and give you guys a call.
Okay.
What phone number is there?
Is we're at 347.
Okay.
324. 3859.
59.
Yes.
Yeah. 347.
347-324-3859.
3859. There we go.
Correct.
Okay. Well, let me make this last point, and then I'll just call back, call in.
Okay.
The legislatures, when they do an application, this is not like, again, two guys get together and say, let's apply to the for a convention. It's a legal, formalized action by the states. It has to go through both houses, ordinarily. It has to be voted on, and it is usually submitted with a quote of Article 5 and then whatever issue, if they want to discuss one, that they want to deal with. It's a formal petition in that it even is usually accompanied by a signature of the governor and a certification by their Secretary of State. So we're not talking about just a piece of paper that somebody slips in, they sign it, and away it goes. We're talking about a formal actual action. Yeah, the states do understand. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to cut out for just a second, and I'll get on the phone and be talking to you in just a second.
Okie dokie.
All right, be right back.
Doug,
and while we wait for him to come back on, Loki, this is quite an educational show. I mean, I think you are saying you didn't know, and
if you didn't know,
we didn't.
You know, I was not understanding that an Article 5 convention had been called for so
many times.
Long.
Uh-huh.
To me, and actually I want to, let's see if this is him back in again.
Yep, that's me.
All right.
Oh, well, that's loud and clear.
Oh, good.
I do have a question for you, and I'm gonna throw a little twist into this. And we talk about the Article 5 convention and how what Congress is doing and violating the Constitution by basically not allowing an Article 5 convention. But aren't they also violating Amendment 1, which allows us to petition our government for redress of grievances? And isn't that why you would call an Article 5 convention?
Well, I would say that the Article 5 convention is a mechanism whereby the petitions, if the government doesn't deal with them, can be resolved. I would say that they're interlocked in that sense. So,
okay.
Yeah, I would say that they're tied. They're not constitutionally; they are two separate things. I mean, if you walk into the government, say your congressman, and hand him a petition, it may or may not concern an amendment to the Constitution. But the principle is the exact same, that the government basically has to listen, which is what the petitions are for. But in the case of Article 5, it's more than just saying, hey, we'd like to have you listen to us. It's saying, hey, this is the way it's going to be. Your bosses are speaking. We're making an amendment. You're going to follow it. In other words, it's a think of it like a focus group with an attitude.
Well,
I mean, that's basically what it is.
I'm beyond
a focus group with an attitude.
Yeah.
I love that.
I mean, I am so upset with what my government is trying to shove down our throats.
Yeah, and what's interesting is when you start listening to the nations that have held a convention around the world, you start to really realize, they've had them in Australia, New Zealand, China, Russia, Venezuela, and this is all in the last 10, 15 years. And I would lay you odds that most people listening to this don't even know they held them. That's how quiet and how ridiculous that people are talking about conventions. I mean, you're talking about two that were held in Afghanistan and Iraq in the middle of a war,
mm-hmm.
and that was it. They were quietly held, and nothing happened.
Now, another question I have, or maybe a point that I want to bring up, I don't know whichever way you want to look at it, did I just lose my train of thought? Probably did. Yeah, we'll continue on. We got a call. I'll get it back. All of a sudden, my synapses just kind of crackled and popped, and I was done.
You're short-circuiting, Loki.
Yeah, I'm short-circuiting. Hey.
You're starting to run out of, you're running out of gigabytes there. You're going to have to get some more memory.
We do have another call for you, sir.
It's the shock of finding out what the Congress
is
doing.
And it really does bother me that, and unfortunately, I
I have to blame myself that I didn't know this was going on, because I'm usually fairly good at trying to keep track of my government.
All these listeners depending on you, Loki. Oh, geez.
Well, they can depend on me more. I have some more knowledge, so.
Well, that's why I'm so glad that you brought Bill Walker on the show. And Bill, I was telling him while we were waiting for you to call back in how informational this episode of Founding Truth has been. This is the type of episode that he and I created this show for, was
yeah.
to inspire and educate.
Well, we at FOABC, that's one of our main goals, is to educate people. For example, we're discussing, after we gather up these applications, we are going to put them on DVD, where we're going to donate them to various places. We're still compiling what kind of list it is, but we're going to make sure that this knowledge is not lost. It's not going to be buried again by the Congress. Now, we may or may not succeed in getting Congress to react. If the mainstream media keeps it silent, you know, they figure it's all died. Well, no, because somebody else is going to hear about this. It's going to be spread through the Internet. Somebody's going to pick it up at some point in the future, and they're not going to have to spend all the time looking for this information. They're going to have those 600 apps right there, bang, and be able to go with them. And, you know, that is the point. We're not going to let this be buried again. It's going to be out there, and we're going to see it stays out there so that
right.
people know about this. And the longer it stays out there, the more people are going to find out it and be offended. I mean, you know, you've got a Congress that sits at a great whopping 9% popularity, you know. And, I mean, politically, what gets me about all this, really, from the political point of view, is the Congress is absolutely totally ridiculous about this. I mean, they have the 100% political cover in this thing. They can walk in and call a convention, and no matter what happens, it goes south, it goes north, it's the greatest thing since sliced white bread, it's a complete failure, it doesn't matter. They've got 100%. They say, look, it's peremptory. We had to do it, folks. Don't blame us, man. It's the Constitution says it. You want to change, hey, we'll propose our amendment ourselves, no problem. But they got 100% political cover, and they won't call it. I mean, that's raw political power when you're sitting there having complete absolution by the Constitution, and you still won't do it.
Now I remember my train of thought. I'm going to get this out before I forget. How much do you think that this was caused by? There was a time in this nation where the people that were selected to Congress looked at it as a honor to serve their nation. And now we have members of Congress that look at it that this is a career choice.
Right.
And, I mean, these people, they went to Congress. They did their 2 months or 3 months or however long it took to get business done. And, you know, they went in January. They went back home, and they continued on with their job, whether it was as a shopkeeper, manufacturer, a clergy, an attorney, a farmer, or whatever. But they went back and did their job. And to be elected by the people to serve in that capacity was an honor. And now it is, the way I see it, it is a career.
Right. And this convention, or obeying the Constitution in general, is a threat to that career. Because, one, it was never intended to be, well, I can't say it was never intended to be a career, but it certainly wasn't intended to be the kind of career that it's developed into. And two, and most importantly, it's a very limiting career. If you actually look at the things that Congress is empowered to do, in Article 1, Section 8, and one of them is not regulating the convention, by the way. They have no legislative authority. The Supreme Court said that they can't do it because they said the president in 1790, they said this. The president has no part of the amendatory process. I would say yes, that has a great deal to do with it. There wasn't that many applications through the 1800s when this type of attitude existed. There were some. There were some for just trying to get to deal with the slavery issue. There were a couple other issues about trying to end the Civil War, but it really wasn't pushed by the states for a various bunch of historic and political reasons. There were some after, for example, after the nullification in the 1832, South Carolina and a couple other states put in some. But it really wasn't used by the states until the 1900s started in. By then, I think that this attitude of self-fulfillment and avarice had begun to take hold. And it's interesting that if you take a look at when it started to happen, was just about the time that Congress decided they weren't going to obey the Constitution about Article 5. In fact, very close together. The income tax, the Federal Reserve Bank, a lot of people talk about these. That all coincided just about the same time as when they refused to call a convention the first time.
And, you know, the time frame you're mentioning is very interesting because our show last week with Doug and I was based on that time period between 1900 and 1920, and what happened in not only in the government, but, you know, and we went through various incidents that happened that really started the ball rolling to stripping away the government from the people.
Right, and it's continued now to the point. It's now, you know, 20 years ago, 20, 25 years ago, you made jokes about it. And people laugh. Now it's getting dead serious. I mean, people are getting to the point that, Jefferson phrased it in the Declaration of Independence. He did a lot more eloquently than I'm going to say it, but he said it. The American people are prone to take a lot of things from the government. Sooner or later, they're going to get mad and blow up.
Well,
I mean, it's just that simple.
Yeah, you can only kick a dog so long before he bites you.
He's
going to
bite
back. You were saying 25 years ago they kind of laughed about it. 25 years ago, they were considered conspiracy theories.
Right, right.
Now, people are scratching their head going, holy cow, what have we gotten ourselves into?
Yeah, and the biggest one of all in my mind, well, the biggest one of all is the fact that all of this could be changed by a system that the government has been involved in, and criminal conspiracy is the right word to use. And where'd they hide it? Right in public record and plain point of view. Poe was right. You're going to hide something, best place, the most obvious. They stuck it in the congressional record. I mean, that's what they did. They'd get a memorial from one of these states, they put it in the congressional record, goes to the Committee of Judiciary, and they leave it there. And if there's any doubt that this is deliberate, the ratification votes for amendments that they have proposed, such as, for example, the 25th Amendment, to use an example. If you read the texts of the applications, you'll find a few. In fact, we show one example on our site, where right next to a memorial for a convention application is a ratification decision by a state. In other words, they literally are the same thing. The Congress records and keeps the track of the other and deliberately buried the other right next to each other, right? Just bang, bang next to each other. There's no way that they couldn't have made a deliberate decision to ignore the convention applications.
Well, and, you know, this is my question is, with Congress so blatantly ignoring us and ignoring the people. I mean, the states are the people. That was how it was all set up to be.
Mm-hmm.
That the states were the people. That was the people speaking. Now, here's a question. We're going back to 1900 to 1920 again. The 17th Amendment, which I look at the 17th Amendment, was bad because it took away representation of the states in the federal government and made it just basically representation of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And it, which also brought in, you know, as far as the way I look at it through my readings, different things. And this is why we have a lot of corruption in the Senate. Is because of that, because of the special interest groups, where now they're being elected by the populace instead of the states. They're no longer doing the state bidding in the federal government.
Yeah, the original idea for the founders, if you read the Federalist and other papers, is that the senators were to be sort of like ambassadors from the states. That was their original kind of concept.
Right.
And yeah, the 17th Amendment, but of course by then, the main reason that it happened is that, for example, the state of Oregon like I said, I live up here in the Northwest, so I'm familiar with it. The state of Oregon had one time that they had two senators. One guy died, and the other guy's term was up. So they had to appoint both of them. The one guy that they wanted to appoint, he died again, so they had two guys that died, and the other guy was arrested on several corruption and morals charges, so he was out of the picture. And the state legislature could not decide on two other guys to take the place, and ultimately the state of Oregon ended up with no representation in the Senate for almost 6 months.
Yeah.
So that was what caused this direct election by the people. The idea of that time was that the people would have a say in direct elections. Again, they went in with the applications, but we don't know that what the convention would have written would have been what Congress came up with. We don't know that. And like I said, some of the applications definitely dealt with election of the president and vice president. So the 17th Amendment most likely would have dealt with all three types of elections, not just the one.
Yeah, this is, you know, this is so interesting because this is not an aspect I've ever pursued. Now I'm going to start doing that, trust me.
The wheels are turning in his mind now,
yeah,
Bill. Thanks a lot. Now you got Loki really thinking.
No, this is my nation. And,
right, exactly. I'm teasing you, but you know,
Loki
is one of the folks I respect because he hears something and he's able to do something that most of us Americans either can't do or just don't do, and that is he makes sure he finds out everything he can about whatever it is he wants to know about. And this is the reason why he's become such a valuable member of the Blog Talk Radio family. And, this is something, though, that, if it caught Loki by surprise, you can just imagine what the rest of us are feeling. And this is why it's so important, and this is why we appreciate you so much coming on this show tonight and discussing this and educating us and letting us know that, as you know, and I agree with you, I believe in the American people, but as much as we thought our rights as a nation, as a people, individuals, was being taken away when it comes to our government, it's worse than we thought, and it's a call to action is what it is. It's an opportunity to get even more involved.
And the thing that gets me and that people should realize is, you know, people are talking a lot in this election about change. You know, you hear that, everybody's using that phrase for change, da-da-da-da-da. And it's both sides. I mean, I've heard Republicans and Democrats use it. The point is that if you want change in the government, you don't do it by election. It wasn't designed to. I mean, if you read the powers of a president, even the ones that they assume, they're not designed to change much of anything. The president is actually, as far as changing things, is pretty powerless. He can't really do much. And the members of Congress are effectively pretty neutralized. That's why there's an amendatory process. If you want to change things in this nation, if you want to really affect change, you go to the amendatory process. It's basically, people haven't realized yet that, you know, if you're going to unscrew a screw, you don't get out a hammer and beat it, you get out a screwdriver. They're reaching for the wrong tool in the toolbox. And, you know, you want to affect change, the amendatory process is there. And if you start reading these texts of these applications, you're going to realize that there's a lot of issues there that are as valid today as they were when they were proposed clear back in the 1920s. Things politically have not changed in a lot of ways. And they deserve the ability of the American public to discuss them. I'm not saying that they'd all get proposed. I'm just simply saying that we, as Americans, have the right to discuss it and, in this case, resolve the issues.
Right, and I think that's a big thing what you're saying there is, you know, that all these issues aren't going to get proposed. But we do, as American citizens, have the right to hear them.
Sure.
And to hear all these issues.
And debate them. I mean, think about what your program would be like. Let's just give people an idea what your... Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're still here.
Yeah, what your program would be like for if there was a convention. You'd have probably the same number of delegates that a Congress has. So you'd have 535 people that you could bring onto your programs and talk about these issues. If the states did nothing else, you're going to have at least 18 or 19 issues right now. And, of course, obviously, you know there's going to be other stuff that's going to be proposed by people, by the states, by the delegates themselves, so on and so forth. You'd probably have around 25 or 30 different subjects. You're talking, on your program alone, if you had two delegates a week, you'd have a full year of discussion on just the subjects that are already been applied for. And, you know, it'd be all over the place. And the thing is that it would be a totally different situation of discussing an issue because at the end, everybody involved would know there's going to be a decision here. It's really going to happen. You know, this isn't going to be, I'm going to write a political blog and nothing, nobody cares. It's going to be leading towards an actual decision of the issue. It's not going to be if this delegate has a great smile. It's going to be, how's he going to argue this position on X? Or why, or whatever. In other words, people are crying for issues to be discussed. Well, a convention is 100% issues.
And I think, and you're absolutely right. You know, and it's the same thing. I'm always kind of concerned about these frivolous issues, which I think do not belong in the federal government. That they belong to the states, that are state issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think, you know. When we talk about an Article 5 convention, I think that's one of my biggest concerns. And I'm talking on both sides of the aisle, too. You know, if we talk about the abortion issue. No, that's a state issue. And it should have never gotten to the Supreme Court. That should have been left up to the state courts.
Right.
I
understand what you're saying as far as that position. And abortion is on the deck. It's sitting there.
Oh, I know it is. And
yeah.
And again, you know, and you can call me a purist or whatever, but I believe in the pure intent of the Constitutional or the Convention of 1787, where they wanted to increase the powers of the central government, but also limit them.
Well, just imagine for just a second, if you really want to think about it, what would it have been like if Congress had acted the way they did in 1787 with the way they're dealing with an Article 5 convention?
Uh-huh.
I mean, just if you want to really think of how scary this can be, if we had not had a convention, if Congress had had the same attitude in 1787, 1788, 1786, that they did when they made that call, they came out and they made that call and said, okay, we're going to start down the convention. If they'd have had the same attitude they've got with an Article 5, we'd have never had a Constitution. We'd have never been the nation that we are. We'd have never been able to resolve the Articles of Confederation. And sooner or later, we would have exploded. There's no question in anybody's mind that historically that the Articles of Confederation ultimately would have failed. We'd have ended up with groups of states being nations or who knows what. I mean,
scenario. Right. I mean, and they saw that. And,
right. And
I think the straw that broke the camel's back was Shays' Rebellion.
Oh, yeah. That had a lot to do with it.
And when they realized that the federal government needs to have more power,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, the delegates to the Convention of 1787 also realized that they did not want to give the central government too much power.
No.
That they could trample on the rights of the states and the people.
Right. And they came up with a very brilliant document. Now, I refuse to believe that Americans, as a collective group, cannot do the same kind of thing with amendments. I don't believe it. I don't believe that in this day and age that we have got nothing but a bunch of dummies running around this country. I believe I wouldn't even have been involved in this movement if I didn't believe in the American people and their ability to work out a problem if they're given the tools to do it. And I believe that delegates can be elected by the people safely. I believe that a convention can be held properly, and I believe that issues and problems will be addressed in a serious legal manner by these delegates, and they will come up with proposed solutions, which then are going to be debated, and I guarantee you there'd be mass debate on what they come up with
to deal
with the problems. And that's the way, what American is about, is, you know, open public debate of an issue and reaching a conclusion to whatever that issue is.
What's wrong with that?
I mean, that's the American way.
And with compromise. And, you know, look at who you're dealing with here on this show. You're listening to two Navy-educated high school graduates. That's it.
Yeah. And, you know, and yet Congress, in its smugness, has sat there and tried to propose legislation where they would do literally everything. They would pick the officers. Every measure they've had has had a veto of the legislation. In other words, they're saying, after you propose it, if we let you have, and it's not the subject we want, or after you propose it, we get to decide by vote whether or not it's going to go for ratification. We can veto it. Now, to get an idea of how blatant this got, the last thing that was done was by a congressman named Blibley, I believe his name was, Bilby or Blibley, 1999. He wrote it, and it's a double reverse. He said, if a piece of legislation that opposes the proposed amendment is not voted against by 2/3 of each house of the Congress, then it gets out. In other words, he basically said, you've got this automatic legislation, and unless Congress rejects it by 2/3 vote, in other words, they basically have to have a vote the same as what they'd get for their own proposal. And like you said, that's 10,000 to 7 to 27. That's the odds. The thing is vetoed. It's an automatic veto sitting there, and they have to vote. They have to vote to get it through. Now, that's their attitude. That's how they have viewed a convention and the right of the people to have a debate.
Well, and you know, they don't understand that the convention is very simple. Once the proposals are put forth by the convention, they're done.
Yeah, they're gone. That's it. They have a term of office that would be, if it is a virtual convention, such as many people have discussed, would be on the Internet. Because if you think about it, you really don't need to physically meet. I mean, you're discussing issues, you're discussing ideas, you're exchanging. That describes the Internet perfectly.
Right.
It 100% written record. It gets rid of a lot of the personality and people trying to perform for the TV cameras and everything else. And it has the added advantage that the people that are representing you in this convention stay at home, where they are right there with the people that elected them, so they can consult and talk to them. So they're not off 3,000 miles away. And because of that, they can afford, the people that couldn't ordinarily afford to be delegates can be delegates because they can keep their jobs. They can work at night. They can work on the weekends. But put
right.
that aside. If it is a virtual convention, you have that. If it's a physical convention, it's going to last, what, a week? And they're gone. That's it. They're done.
Right.
They don't get reelected. They don't have a campaign fund. They're going to be nonpartisan. They're going to write some amendment proposals. And they've done it hundreds of times in the states. I mean, they've had conventions. And name me the last really dramatic convention in one of the states. Most people couldn't even tell you when the last convention was held in the state.
I think ours here in Michigan was back in the 60s.
Yeah.
But
was there anything notable about it that comes to mind?
No.
People don't even.
We also have the ability to put referendums on the ballot to change our Constitution.
Sure. And they have various systems in various states to do different things. The point being that the convention itself has long since been proven that it's a viable system to bring about peaceful constitutional change.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Besides,
we've tried
everything else. Why not try this?
Yeah, why not? I mean, we got to do something before this country explodes.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm looking at. You know, we have to change things. We have to change things. It all depends on what avenue we take to produce this change.
Mm-hmm.
I would much rather do it with a, you know, constitutional convention than do it peaceably, instead of seeing people in this nation get so fed up that they pick up arms to change things.
Yes, and it's happened twice in our country that way.
No, yes, it has. And, well, Bill, we're cutting real short on time, and Doug has to go to get ready for
his own show that starts in about 6 minutes. And
well, I've appreciated you asking me on, and I've enjoyed the interview.
Well,
Bill, it's been our pleasure, and Loki, if you don't mind me saying this real quick. Bill, I have not learned so much as I have tonight. The only other person I've learned this much constitutionally from is Loki himself, and your information, your educating us, is very valuable. Please do continue doing what you are doing, and thank you for taking the time to be on Founding Truth with us tonight.
I appreciate it, and I just hope that everybody listening just spreads the word, tell your friends, your pals, your buddies, talk about it at work, post emails, blogs, whatever, and, keep pressuring Congress, and maybe things will change for real.
Another thing, Bill, I want to extend an invitation to you to come back on the show at some later date.
I'll be happy to. Just email me, and be happy to.
I mean, I've totally enjoyed this. I've been educated myself on this Article 5 thing, and that is, that really bothers me. I'm going to do some more research on it, and I'm going to start making some calls to my – well, actually, I'm trying to get my congressman on a show here anyways. And
please let me know if you do. I'd love to hear when you ask him the question about Article 5. If he runs
– oh, I definitely will. Trust me.
Just to remind everyone one more time about the website, it's www.foavc.org.
And just for those, it's Foxtrot Oscar Alpha Victor
Charlie.
.org.
Mm-hmm.
And to remember my phonetic alphabet, I've been out of the Navy for 20-some-odd years. So.
Oh, no. I remember the phonetic alphabet better than that. Come on, Mal, my friend.
I'm sorry, I just... Yeah, I've tried to divorce myself. And, Bill, again, thank you very much for being on the show tonight. It was extremely informative, and I hope our listeners here understand what we are up against. And
I appreciate it.
This is just another aspect of our government trying to squelch the people.
Exactly.
And thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Bye-bye.
So, Doug, what did you think? I thought that was a great, great show.
All I have to say is when it comes to guest buddy, you know how to pick them.
Well, this is something, I mean, this involves the Constitution. I mean, what can I say?
This is the type of show that we created this show for.
Absolutely. This is why what we're doing here is unconstitutional issues. To understand our Constitution, to educate our listeners and everybody else out there that wants to tune in, to listen to this show, to understand what our Constitution is, what our rights are as citizens of this great nation. And with that, I'm going to let you go to get your show started. And as always, God bless our troops. And God bless the United States of America.